It's time for TWiT This Week in Tech. And we've got a surprise guest today. Jerry Pournelle's here. Larry Magid. Christina Warren will talk about the latest tech news, Apple's quarterly results, iPhone rumors, and a tale of two selfies. Plus our special guest coming up next on TWiT.
Netcasts you love.
From people you trust.
This is TWiT.
Bandwidth for This Week in Tech is provided by CacheFly at CacheFly.com. This is TWiT This Week in Tech, episode 468, recorded July 27th, 2014. Surfing the Apocalypse. This Week in Tech is brought to you by Stamps.com. Start using your time more effectively with Stamps.com. Use Stamps.com to buy and print real U.S. postage the instant you need it, right from your desk. For our special offer, visit Stamps.com, click the microphone, and enter TWiT. That's Stamps.com, offer code TWiT. And by Harry's. For guys who want a great shave experience for a fraction of what you're paying now, go to Harry's.com. Get $5 off your first purchase by entering the code TWIT5 when you check out. And by Jira, an Atlassian product. Jira is the product management solution for teams planning, building, and launching great products. To learn more about Jira and try it free for 30 days, visit Atlassian.com/TWIT. It's time for TWiT This Week in Tech, the show that covers the week's tech news in a very kind of special show today. We welcome, of course, Christina Warren, film girl. Always great to have her from Mashable, joining us from the East Coast. Larry Magid of CBS Radio in his brand new studio, joining us from the West Coast. Nice to have you, Larry. But we've got two veterans of science fiction, two of the greatest writers I know. Jerry Pournelle, of course, has been on TWiT many times. We've talked about Jerry's books. And, of course, my career was inspired by Jerry's column, Chaos Manor, in Byte Magazine for many years. Chaos Manor's back. We're going to talk about that. But Jerry is not in his usual den with the wall-to-wall books. You're somewhere else, Jerry. Where are you today?
I'm in Larry Niven's office.
Larry Niven?
Can you hear me?
I hear you. And I love
Larry Niven.
Boy, I would love to meet Larry Niven. He, of course, your co-author for Lucifer's Hammer. So many great books. And the creator of the Ringworld series and so forth. It'd be so fun. One of these days you have to bring him on the show with you, will you? He's not
all
getting
right.
Done. There he is. Ladies and gentlemen, it's so nice to meet you. Larry Niven, such a fan. And so glad that you and Jerry continue to collaborate. I didn't realize you were still working on books together.
We love collaborating. It's how we get our hiking in. Talk story during a hike.
Really?
It's not better than what we used to do, which was drink.
Oh, you've gone healthy on us. That's kind of cool. So in fact, a lot of people in Silicon Valley do this. Steve Jobs very famously would take job prospects on a hike with him. Mark Zuckerberg mm-hmm. now does something similar. I think the blood is going, the mind's working, and I think there's also I read somewhere a law that if you're distracted by something, your subconscious can work more effectively, and it's you are more creative. That's why you have great ideas in the shower.
Yes. Hiking works, and Jerry's theory is that we're getting more blood to the brain.
Absolutely. And until you start showering together, it'd probably be the best way to collaborate.
Yeah, we haven't done that.
So what are you
probably not like.
not in the cards? Huh? What do you guys?
We've
so you
a sauna though.
Sauna, a very good place to come up with great ideas.
Yeah, Larry has a sauna.
I love saunas. I'm a fan. So are you still in California, guys, or what state are you in?
We're in California, in Chatsworth, California.
Chatsworth.
Right. Oh, it's the northwest corner of Los Angeles County.
Yeah. So you're not far from home, Jerry.
No, about 20 miles.
Right? Oh, all right. So
it used to be a little closer. He used to be in Tarzana, which was a very appropriate place for a science fiction writer to be from.
wait a minute. Is Tarzana named after Tarzan?
Yeah. Oh, the apes, yes.
Edgar Rice Burroughs, who was also a science fiction confabulist as well.
The Burroughs family owned most of the land, and they developed it, so.
I had no idea. with the proceeds from the Tarzan books?
Yes. And the related science fiction. He was the king of science fiction.
He was. I know.
And there is a display of Tarzan memorabilia in the Tarzana post office.
I had no idea. I think you should have a town called Lucifahama.
I fear not.
not quite so much. What are you guys? Jerry kind of alluded to the fact that you are working on something new together. What are you working on?
Let me start with a conversation that happened during a hike. We were hiking with E.E. King, whom you haven't met, and Stephen Barnes, I don't know, and Jerry and me. We were hiking, and the subject of Lucifer's Hammer came up. And I presently admitted that I had always known how to save the surfer.
Gil the Surfer, and you, I have seen quotes that you say you wish you had saved him.
If you've seen that, I'm not sure where they came from.
Okay.
Because they demanded I save him, write a story saving him. And I kind of waffled and thought about it for a while, and I decided I didn't want to save him.
Really?
So what I've written is a ghost story.
So just for people who haven't read, and you should read Lucifer's Hammer, a giant comet hits planet Earth. It causes a huge tidal wave. The surfer decides if he's going to go, he's going to go with a bang, and tries to ride the tidal wave, which would have worked fine had an apartment building not intervened. Am I correct?
Yeah.
Is that an accurate sense?
That's a good, succinct description of it. Accurate in every respect.
Let me set a piece of stage here. You understand that on a collaboration, we each do about 90% of the work. But the surfer's all his. I couldn't have dreamed that up in a million years. So Nature magazine, a few years ago, had a 30th anniversary of Lucifer.
Oh, we hear Jerry talking off mic. We got to get Jerry back because his Skype just dropped out. You're still there. Go slap the back of his head.
But you're not.
Yeah. Come on. Go sit next to Larry, Jerry. Alex! Jerry's son, Alex, who is really a good IT guy. Both Larry Maggot and I know him from all those trade shows that he does the IT for, including Showstoppers. Not yet. We're working on it.
No, I don't see it. Jerry, he's hearing your voice, but...
Well, I'm hearing him from a distance. I'm hearing him through your mic, Larry.
Your screen is showing something else.
Yeah. His Skype is down. We only hear him because we hear him through your mic.
Can you hear me?
Yeah, through.
Far away!
You're hearing Jerry through my mic?
Yeah, that's why we can hear him.
His Skype just go into your... If you don't mind having fit
his mic.
If you guys can sauna together, you can share a studio.
Here I am.
Hey!
There we go.
You
got him.
Yep, okay.
There you
go. Okay. So back to the story.
Set the stage.
Okay. So anyway, Nature magazine runs this review of Lucifer's Hammer on the 40th anniversary of it or something of the sort. So we did a lot of science and technology in that story, right?
Oh, yeah.
So what is the first page of Nature magazine, which is the world physics magazine? What does it chart? Well, of course, it has the surfer scene. So everybody remembers the surfer if they don't remember another thing in the story. So now you know why Niven and I work together. I do the plots, and he does the stuff people remember.
I love it. It is very memorable for some reason. You know what I remember most from Lucifer's Hammer, and I think I've mentioned this to you before, Jerry, is that when the infrastructure of the world is destroyed, as it is by this comet, it turns out that everybody has been using technology, but nobody knows how to remake it. It's almost, for us, magical. And it really reminds me of the world we live in today, where, you know, we may be using iPads and computers and smartphones, but what we could we recreate it if something should happen? Probably not.
Well, yes and no. That, and actually, the story Larry wrote, which may be a ghost story and may be real, has a good bit of some of the aftermath to it as to what's happening. It's certainly true that most of the people in this world accept fruits of technology in about the same way as a kitten accepts milk when you pour it into a bowl for it, and are about as capable of recreating it as a kitten would be. But there are still some people who can do it. You remember Lucifer's Hammer?
Yeah.
We did preserve the knowledge of how to do a lot of that.
Yes.
Much of it preserved as books wrapped in Ziploc bags and thrown into a septic tank to hide them. But
By a wizard. We turned one of our friends into a wizard.
Well, I'm really glad to hear that there's more coming. When are we going to see this and where?
It's my turn, and I guess I'll need to get... I've been playing with my new toy. You were talking about the Wall Street Journal. I had it on the screen here a minute ago.
What is that?
This is a Session, or I'm sorry, a Surface.
Oh, you got the Surface Pro 3, the new Microsoft Surface.
I have a Surface Pro 3, and I'm just getting to learn about it, so I'm not going to say too much now. But I love it.
Larry Niven, are you as much of a geek as Jerry is?
No, I'm not. I don't have the nerve for it. as I was telling you earlier, I have a perfectly good low heartbeat. Sorry. Perfectly good low blood pressure because I don't try to solve machines the way Jerry does.
It will put you...
I watched him for years. He always goes nuts. He goes into a flurry of confusion and gradually works his way out of it much more easily and much further than I could.
Is why I read Chaos Manor each and every month in Byte Magazine. You said, Larry, Jerry, that's kind of coming back. What's the latest with Chaos Manor?
When I learn this machine a little better, there's my Wall Street Journal. When I get a little more used to this, I'm calling it the precious, as in, oh, my precious. I will be doing so within a month.
Good.
We lost him again.
And I hope he can figure out how to use Skype before. No, it's because we're sharing Skype with Larry Niven and Jerry Pornell, and unfortunately, Alex got yours working better, Larry, than he got Jerry's working. I'm sorry to say. Larry, what do you use to write with?
And it was agony. I watched the agony.
It is agony. And you see, your blood pressure is already going up. Kick Jerry right out right now if I were you. Oh, and Christina's gone. The whole thing's falling apart. The wheels the wheels are falling off the show. Larry Niven, you do write on a computer at least, right?
Yes, I do. Jerry Pornell and a guy named Tony Peach worked up a computer for use by writers. And when he had it perfected, he made me duplicate it. And I duplicated it twice because those were the days when you needed spare parts.
Do you use Microsoft Word? What do you write in?
Microsoft Word didn't exist then. Yes, I use Microsoft Word today.
For some reason, I imagine both you and Jerry using some ancient tech, PFS Write or something, some ancient technology.
Jerry keeps up.
Yeah, he keeps up.
Yeah.
But a lot of writers I know don't want to think about the technology. They want it to get out of the way. They just want to write. Who was it? George R.R. Martin uses WordStar.
Yeah.
This is
the DOS days.
This is the Wizard of Chaos Manor you're talking about.
Yeah, no, Jerry.
He has to keep up. Yeah. Even when a science fiction writer doesn't.
It's so true. Hey, Larry Niven, I want to thank you so much for being here. I look forward to finding out what happens to Gil the Surfer, a ghost story. And kick Jerry in the butt, because apparently Jerry's just falling down on the job these days.
It'll be a bigger story by the time Jerry gets through. He's got some other things going elsewhere in the world following Lucifer's Hammer.
Is he the wordy one?
Yeah, Jerry's the wordy one. Yes.
I work angles, Leo. Larry has told a perfectly good story. It would be publishable now. But when I'm finished with it, it will be probably half again, maybe twice as long, and it will have some subplots in it that are not in what he has done. And I make them all come together, and then he goes over it and finds some scene that everybody will remember, and they'll forget that I ever had any part in it. But what the hell?
Jerry's a filigreeist. He just adds the little Baroque detail to the...
I'm the filigreeist.
Yeah, that's close.
And I'm the mad one. Jerry's entirely happy with the notion that I'm the mad one.
Well, you'll have to...
He does the sanity.
You'll have to forgive me for being a little fanboy here, but I am so thrilled to get to talk to you. You know, Jerry, of course, an inspiration for my career, but I love the stuff you do together, and Larry Nevin's Ringworld, and all the stuff that you've done on your own, too, is just some of the best science fiction ever written, and a must-read for anybody who hasn't yet. Just start with Ringworld and work your way through that by itself. Then start with Lucifer's Hammer, The Mote in God's Eye. Jerry's even done some young adult stuff, I know, with this theme. There's a lot of great stuff to read. And Roberta, right?
I get some short stories.
Is Roberta writing, too? Who's writing? Your daughter's writing, right?
My daughter, Jennifer, has written a sequel to Mote, yes.
So it's a family thing. I'm telling you, we're working on Moteville, USA. If Edgar Rice Burroughs could have it, you can too. Thank you so much, Larry Nevin. We're going to let you go because we're going to get very boring right now as we talk about tech news.
Okay, have fun.
Take care.
Nice to meet you, Larry.
More Audis. Boy, it's so fun. One of the great science fiction writers. Jerry, thank you for bringing Larry on. I've always wanted to get the two of you together. You know what I'd like to do down the road is maybe do an hour with the two of you.
Yeah,
if we could work that out, I'd like to do that. Let's take a break. When we come back, we've got some big stories to talk about. I guess just came out the final word that YouTube has purchased Twitch. This was rumored for months. Twitch.tv for $1 billion. We'll talk about that and a whole lot more coming up with Film Girl, Christina Warren from Mashable, Larry Magid from CBS.
Thank you. That was fun.
Jerry Purnell. It was fun. Thank you, Larry. We appreciate it. Our show today brought to you by our friends at Stamps.com. Why go to the post office? If you're mailing stuff for your business, you want to do a great job on fulfillment. Stamps.com gives you all the power of a professional mailing house at your desk, better than the post office. Use your computer, your printer. You don't need a special inks. You don't need a postage meter. You just need Stamps.com. And most of all, you don't need to be a tech expert. So if you're selling on Etsy or eBay or Amazon, if you're a business where you send out mailers or invoices, why go to the post office, buy stamps, put them on? It's not professional looking. With Stamps.com, you can print right on the envelope. Your logo, the return address is automatically there. You could pull the sender's, the recipient's address from your QuickBooks, from your website. It just makes it easy. Plus, you'll get discounts you can't get at the post office. If you're sending express mail or priority mail, you get discounts. Plus, they'll send out the email for you automatically, the confirmation email, return receipt. They do international customs forms automatically, automatic address verification. It really is a great way to do it. Even discounted package insurance, all in one click. And you know the best part is the mail carrier comes to your house, picks it up, takes it away. That's it. You're done. There's even a big button on the Stamps.com site that says, bring that carrier back out of here again. I want him again. Post office loves Stamps.com. They're a perfect partner. You will too. And that's why I want you to try it right now with our no-risk trial. It's a $110 bonus offer. If you go to Stamps.com, click the microphone in the upper right-hand corner, and you'll get a digital scale, $55 in free postage. You'll get a $5 supplies kit and a 4-week trial of Stamps.com. This is a great offer. So go to Stamps.com before you do anything else. Click the microphone at the top of the homepage. Type into it. If you are doing mailing for your business, you really need to know about Stamps.com. And I always, it's so funny because I get a lot of packages. Every day I get packages. And I can always tell, you know, if it's a professional outfit or if there's 18 stamps on there. I know the difference. Let's see. This was a week for quarterly profits. This is kind of sometimes the least interesting news of the year, you know, how Apple did, how Microsoft did. Apple sold 35.2 million iPhones in its third quarter. It's the slowest quarter. They had revenue of $37 billion, not so bad. Anything to deduce from this, or is it just kind of what we were hoping that Tim Cook or the new CFO would leak something about expectations on an iWatch or an iPhone? Larry, did you listen to the conference call? Did they say anything?
No hints of anything that Apple is going to do. I mean, although nothing to contradict what's in the rumor mill either in terms of the iPhone 6 or some of the wearables. The most interesting news, I think, is that iPad sales are down for the second quarter in a row.
Yeah.
And that doesn't really surprise me. I actually predicted at the very beginning that as much as I admired Steve Jobs, I do not think that they were the end of the PC. They were simply another type of PC that people use along with other devices. But as somebody pointed out today, the other problem with iPads is they don't break and they don't.
Everybody's got one.
Got one. If it's 2 or 3 years old, so what? It still does exactly what it's supposed to do. And is it really worth going out and spending hundreds of dollars more for one that's just slightly lighter than the one that was pretty light to begin with? So it may be that they just don't have any replacement market among the enthusiasts. The other problem, of course, is plenty of Android tablets where I'm very picky about my phone. I'm not at all picky about what tablet I use because what I do on it, they all seem to work just fine. And frankly, I don't use tablets very often. I know there are other people who do use them much more frequently than I do, but I think it's not necessarily such a big deal. But so that was to me the news. And the other news is that Macs are doing very well, that despite the supposed post-personal computer era, Apple's personal computer business is thriving, as it deserves to, because they've got some great products out there.
They sold 13.3 million iPhones. That's down 9%.
Yeah.
From this time last year. I'm looking for the Mac sales.
They were like 4.48, I think. Okay. They were up.
Still a fraction of the iPad sales.
Yes.
And would you buy? I wouldn't buy an iPhone. To be honest with you, I wouldn't buy any phone right now until the iPhone 6 comes out. I want to see what it looks like. And I'm telling people, if you can wait till the 6 comes out, whether you're an Android person or an iPhone person, doesn't matter. See what Apple's coming out with and then make your buying decision. And maybe you'll buy an Android phone. But why would somebody buy an iPhone 5S?
Well, in fact, isn't that what Apple, the one kind of personal bit that came through in this call was the moaning and groaning that rumors have depressed iPhone sales.
Yeah, well, duh.
but they were still up. I mean, they were 35.6 million iPhones. That's really high, especially for their slowest quarter. iPads were soft and they were down year over year, but iPhones were actually up. And they were up in a lot of their international markets, which are likely less sensitive about like the new release. So I think that the new releases are mostly like where, you know, they're saturated. So like the United States, Western Europe, whereas other markets, you know, it's just more about getting the first iPhone versus replacing to the latest, greatest.
Yeah.
But yeah, I mean, iPad sales were definitely down, but the iPhone did really well in the Mac sales. Not only, I mean, there's still a fraction of iPhone and of iPad, but when you compare Mac sales to the PC market at large, you know, they are, I think, up 14%, whereas the overall market is like down 20%. So,
right. You
know, it's a really interesting dichotomy right there.
Can we deduce anything from the fact that iPod sales down 36%, iPad sales down 9%, Mac sales up, iPhone sales up? Is there a trend that you can say, well, people are, if they're going to get a computer nowadays, they're going to get a big computer. But most people are just buying phones. It seems to me we're not only in the post-PC world. I've said this before. We're in the post-tablet world. The phone is becoming the device of choice.
Well, exactly.
Yeah. Go ahead, Christina. You say it.
What I was going to say was, I'm with you. I think that maybe the mistake that a lot of us made, and I would include myself in this, is seeing the iPad as the ultimate post-PC replacement when that's not really true. It might be in some situations, maybe education, maybe for certain business scenarios, but the real replacement for the computer, especially in the emerging world, and the developing world, is going to be the phone. So this is what you're going to sell more of time over time rather than the tablet. And you know, to your point from earlier, you know, the life cycle of tablets has been incredibly long. But it is interesting because I was actually writing something this week about how I'm not ready to call tablets the new netbooks yet. I think that we misjudged the market, but I don't think it's dead. But tablet sales, at least in North America, are down across the board. So it's not just Apple sales. They're down worldwide. They're actually expecting only 11% growth for the year, compared with something like 50% growth last year. So I think that, you know, as kind of a boom item, if anybody thought it was going to be the next smartphone, they were wrong. But how long, you know, they last and how they'll merge with current PCs, I think remains to be seen. But yeah, definitely, I think this is going to be, you know, the future computer. For
Jerry,
sure.
Jerry, you love your iPad, but I notice you've got a Surface. Do you feel like that Surface Pro is a tablet, a PC, a laptop, or both?
It may be all of them. One of the things that nobody seems to be considering, though, is that have you seen the Samsung and the other one, the big phones that are about...
I have a Note 3. The Note 4 is coming out. The rumor, and I don't buy it, but the rumor is that Apple will do a 5.5-inch iPhone. That's pretty... We call those phablets. I mean, that's... Yeah. Do you think, Christina, they're going to do a 5.5-inch?
No.
I think that's bogus.
I think it's totally bogus. And I think that what's even more bogus is the rumor that they're going to have two launches.
Right.
That is insane. Anybody who's saying, oh, they're going to release one, and then a few months later, they're going to release another. It's like... No,
they don't do that.
No, they don't do that. And no matter what has changed with Tim Cook, and I think a lot of the changes have been good. That's the fundamental part of Apple is that they keep it very simple. They're not going to release a bigger phone. They're not going to have sell a 3.5-inch, a 4-inch, a 4.7-inch, and a 5.5-inch. Like that's not Apple.
By the way, is that Louise from Bob's Burgers on your?
Yes, it is. Yes.
You are weird.
I was her from Halloween. She's my favorite cartoon character.
Really?
My favorite show. I got ears from Etsy. I was Louise for Halloween. It was the best. And I was so excited. Yeah, a number of people recognized it like on the street, which was awesome. But Burgers retweeted me. I love it.
Really?
Yeah.
Wow. Let me show just folks because you're really kind of. That's your doppelganger, actually.
Totally.
So you're not going to get revenge today?
No, Louise, I'm not.
Okay, got it. Then I won't bring
I think it is Christina Warren. Is that you?
Ninja star.
In those pink ears.
You call my credit card?
Into a ninja star.
Tambourine.
All right, but your smartphone is cool.
I was going to talk about smartphone, and how can you beat
it? But can it do this? That's what I want to know. Look at my smartphone. Well, wait a minute. It's not doing it anymore.
Hang on.
Can it do this? Ooh.
Oh, you got the Amazon.
This is the Fire Phone that no one wants, no one should buy. But that's cool.
Leo, it's worth $200 for that alone.
Try $600, $700.
Oh, you bought it outright. Yeah.
Well, yeah, because it's never $200. You know that, Larry Magan. It's $200 for and 2 years forever.
Slave labor. This is my latest phone. This is the new LG G3.
Oh, you have the G3.
I like that phone.
A lot. Back to Christina's point, I wouldn't go out of my way to read a book or watch a movie on this, but the reality is that most of the time when I want to read a book or watch a movie, I have in my
pocket.
Hold
that up again. That looks like a tablet. That's 5.5 inches.
It's big, but it's big. You know, it fits in my hand. It fits in my pocket.
Pull it back from the camera. Is it just because it's so close? No, it's really that huge.
No,
it's bigger than your head, Larry.
Compare it to, I don't know, what have I got? Well, here is.
Wow. Now, the G3 is the first Ultra HD screen.
Yeah.
Which means it's not 1080p. What is it, 2560 by 1440? It's giant.
Yes.
Really good.
It's the same as the 27-inch iMac. It's insane.
What is the dots per inch on that 5.5? It's like 450, 500?
I think it's 553.
553. See, I don't think you can see anything over 350 or 400, right? I mean, even if it's this close.
You know, my take on the screen is it's great, but all cell phones.
Is it greater than, say, the M8 or the S5?
Practical purposes, they're all fine.
They're all the same.
You know, I wouldn't buy a phone based on display ticks. To me, I buy a phone based on battery life, and this phone has good battery life.
It does.
Better battery life.
And it's removable, right? So you get a second.
Removable.
Yeah.
So that I'd buy it for that reason, but I wouldn't buy it for the screen at all, even though it's a great screen.
So, Christina, you have a 4-inch phone.
I do.
Larry Maggett's using a 5.5-inch phone.
Ooh,
this is a 4.7, which this is going to be the new iPhone. It's going to be the same size as the Fire.
That's I think, the perfect size.
I think so. The Moto X is 4.7. Every time I use a 4.7, I feel like that's how it should be. Just to complete the thought on the Fire Phone. I realize now, having used it, that, you know, there's neat stuff in it. There's that dynamic perspective, which gives it a 3D look.
Yep.
There's the Firefly button. If you press and hold the dedicated camera button, little fireflies show up, and then you take a picture of something, and you could buy it on Amazon. Or if it's a work of art, it'll identify it and stuff like that. It's got the Mayday button, so that means you can get help by pressing a button, and a person will show up in video. But what I realized is that really Amazon has gone wrong on this phone. By forking Android and making their own operating system, even though they're doing some innovative stuff, like this is really annoying when you so here's a game, cool game, but half the screen is wasted on recommendations for other things to buy.
Mm-hmm.
That is annoying. Yeah. When it's mail, it shows me other mail. But when it's a game or apps that don't have any obvious additional information, it shows me it's an ad. That sucks. Here's my audiobooks, and then there shows me an ad for other audiobooks that I haven't purchased. If this had been a true Android phone with a kind of vanilla Android, then I might say, hey, this is a phone to consider because of the Amazon special.
And you pay full price for it. They don't even give you a price break exchange for the fact that it's a selling machine or a buying machine.
Right.
They do give you one break in the sense they give you a year's worth of Prime, which is worth $100.
Right.
So you got to give them credit for that. But other than that, it's the same price as any other high-end phone.
And it's the same specs.
Yeah. Most people, wouldn't you think, who are going to buy this are already Prime users? I mean, if you're going to buy this, part of the big appeal is that you
they add
get the Prime.
They add a year. So it's like $100 rebate if you're a Prime user. Yeah.
I had higher hopes. And, you know, I thought that really, as I think about it, if they had merely made it a standard Android, if they had made it just make this a KitKat.
Yeah.
I think this would be a good phone. I would easily be able to recommend this along with a Moto X and similar phones. I can't now because it's hobbled by this unique OS that it's doing. And there's no Google services, no Google Maps.
And all those ads.
And ads.
Yep.
You can't even use it with your Fitbit.
Now, with the tablet, here's the thing. With the tablet, they did this thing, you know, where they called recommendations. They give you a huge price break on certain Kindle devices in exchange for seeing ads and seeing promotions. And they really do give you a great price break. I mean, they created readers and tablets that truly are a great value in exchange for looking at ads. And I don't mind that because you're getting something in return. But with this, you're paying full price and getting all the ads and getting the selling machine. And to me, that bothers me.
Jerry, you go back to the S100 bus, Ezekiel, right? And
I go back further than that. When we wrote Moat in God's Eye, we had pocket computers that are, well, they were sufficiently descriptive that when the iPhones first came out, a couple of my readers got together and bought me one saying that I had invented it.
I think you did.
We had.
I think you did.
And but we had in mind something a little bigger than this. My eyes are not good enough to read a lot on the screen that small. But Alex has one of these Samsung Galaxies. It takes a scabbard to carry it around. You can't put it in your pocket.
That's a good idea. There's a product category.
And it's closer to the size I had in mind.
I need a smartphone scabbard.
Hand, if I get a shoulder bag that just fits this...
The surface. You think the surface is...
I can see myself using that as a phone, too.
Really?
Yeah, think about it.
I was sitting on the can the other day and my iPad rang and I realized that because I'm being a little honest here. I'm sorry, TMI.
Camera
overshare. But I realized that it started ringing and I realized, because I have Google Hangouts and I use Google Voice, my iPad is a phone and I actually answered the phone. I won't tell you who was calling, but I answered the phone and I realized, wow, I actually do have a phone on all my devices.
Yeah.
Yeah.
My computer.
And that's kind of what I have been thinking is that maybe not as big as the Surface, but something that's big enough that you can comfortably read books on and with a keyboard that actually works, which the Surface keyboard does. It isn't as good as the ThinkPad keyboard, but then what is?
Right.
But I could honestly see myself using this Surface as the only machine.
Would you ever take the keyboard off and use it as a tablet?
Yes. Now, you will understand it recognizes my handwriting, even if it won't recognize yours.
Is that still the case? OneNote also has a Jerry Pournelle recognition engine in it as well?
Yes.
Damn. When is that going to die?
Never.
We've told the story on Twit several times.
Unless they get rid of paragraph as the engine for basically
it's paragraph.
The handwriting recognition engine that Microsoft uses is Stepan Panovich's paragraph from Moscow.
That's so funny. And they're still using that engine.
I've told you this story before. The reason it recognizes my handwriting is that I happen to be in Moscow. He needed some handwriting samples, and I loaned him my logbook. So
was this before or after the Soviet Union fell?
This was in 1989. It was
before.
It was fall.
You were probably brought it down.
It's his fault.
Yeah, well, in a sense, you know, I said back at the time of the Falkland Islands War that it was getting pretty clear. If you take Arthur Kessler said famously that the necessary and sufficient condition for bringing about the collapse of an ideological society would be the free exchange of ideas within it.
I agree. Yeah.
I agree with you.
And
we're seeing it right now.
If you have small computers,
you're
going to have the free exchange of ideas. So I put those two together in 1982. I said the Soviet Union's doomed because if they don't go with learning computer technology and making it widespread, they won't be able to win wars. That's one what the Falkland Islands War showed, is that high tech wins. But if they do, I don't see how they can survive ideologically.
Right.
It's the same issue now with any totalitarian state. And so what they do in Turkey and Egypt and anywhere they can, they turn off the internet, but it's too late.
Too late.
And they can't do it really either.
It's once the cows left the barn or the whatever.
But you understand there are means other than ideologies to...
Jerry,
to
you're sinking. There we go.
I'm sorry. I moved.
He sank off the screen.
Cut my head off.
You, in this
you understand it looks just like my office in the background.
It does.
A little neater, Jerry. No offense. A little cleaner.
But of course, there is a reason for that, isn't there?
Mm-hmm. Book, you writers are readers. So we have in studio with us an interesting fella. He's an Israeli. He's the CTO of a company called Robin Labs. They do Siri-like speech recognition. It's only on Android right now, but they want to put it in cars. Mm. And before the show, we were looking at his demo, and it's really kind of impressive, natural language. Isn't this ultimately the interface? Forget the keyboard, Jerry. Don't you want to talk to your Surface Pro?
Oh, yeah, and of course that's what we did in Molten God's Eye when we were describing these things.
Right.
Remember?
Type.
She used and Heinlein did that in his rather magical car in one of his later models.
But looked
up at the ceiling and said, be a nice girl, and then gave it instructions.
There are two technologies that are going to make this be the smartphone be the computer. One is better battery life. And the other is effective voice recognition.
Right. Yes.
And that eliminates the input issues and the portability issues.
Except for writers. But Jerry, would you really want to write a novel with your voice? I mean, I know people do.
I don't. I can't dictate as fast as I can type.
Me neither. And I know there are people who for variety reasons.
But that's a small minority of people getting smaller all the time.
Unfortunately.
Someday soon. But if you think about it, if you're a videographer or a photographer, there are other ways to communicate. And these devices are really, it's interesting. I mean, people don't buy camcorders anymore, do they?
Mm. Or even inexpensive cameras. What's the point of a point and shoot camera anymore?
Do you find that, Christina?
Definitely. I mean, I went to film school, right? So my actual educational background is in video, and almost all my photography, almost all my video that I do, you know, on my iPhone or on something else. But it's interesting, you know, your point about how people are communicating in different ways. I heard from very good authority that one of the reasons iOS 8 is going to have multiple keyboards is because of how they've watched people in China and in other countries use some of the different keyboards, you know, use the emojis and also use, you know, video chat and use some of those other things. And one of the reasons that they're going to add the ability to send video clips back and forth is because of how common that is in other places. And
there's there's a new social network called Emojily that allows you to communicate only in emojis.
Wow.
So instead of 140 characters, you get 140 emojis.
Emojis.
Emoji only network.
There is no spam.
Because like there isn't an emoji for spam.
There's no spam.
There is one for aubergine. We're not sure why, but you can use it.
No bloody forward this to 10 people memes. No stupid hashtags. The worst message you could possibly receive? It's a pile of poo. Now we know what you're thinking. This is satire. No one would actually make this thing.
Are you and your cohort? Because you're a young person, especially when you're hanging out with us. You're a really young. Emojis were started in Japan. Took over the world when it wasn't for a long time on the iPhone. You had to hack it to put emojis in. Finally, Apple realized, oh, wow, emojis. People like these. They've added it. Android has emojis. Do you find people communicate a lot with emojis?
Yes. I mean, it's insane the number of text messages or chats that I'll have where they are entirely in emoji or reaction GIFs.
What?
Yeah. We've even done stories, and I'm a little proud. It's kind of awesome where we've done things like we've told like the movie Titanic completely in emoji. And we'll do things like we'll do song lyrics or Moby Dick or, you know, various, you know, like great collected works and do it entirely in emoji. It's kind of amazing how much you can do with little pictograph characters. Most of my communication with my husband, if I'm being honest, is emoji and reaction GIFs. And it's just kind of a constant stream of that all day long.
And how's the marriage going?
Good. So far, so good. We'll see. But I mean, you know, right now I'll have like the happy, I'll do happy emoji. I'll say that. But, you know, we'll see.
Mm-hmm. It limits the arguments. I mean, you know, you have to be
It really does. Yeah. You know, just send, you know, a reaction GIF of someone smashing something when you're angry.
Were you able to tell the Titanic in emojis?
Yes.
This is where you need Jerry's filigree. There isn't a lot of.
No. We were trying to tell one of Jerry's novels, you know.
That'd be more complicated. Really
There would be no way, granted. But I mean, you know, when you consider that the most, you know, what's the theory that there's something like only like 6 unique story types or something like archetypes?
Right.
When you think about that, it becomes pretty simple. You know, boy meets girl, you know, boy loses girl, boy gets girl back. I mean, that's pretty easy to tell and you know.
I'm curious.
Characters.
Did somebody invent? Where did these come? I mean, it's from Japan, right?
Yeah, it was a cellular carrier. So it was, I can't remember, I think it was NTT Docomo, but it might have been one of the other ones. Anyway, they had a WAP back in those days, social network sort of thing for their dumb phones. And like 98, 99 is when they started developing it. And one of the ways that they wanted to make it so that people could communicate was that they created these little characters. And it wasn't originally part of the ASCII specification or part of any of the Unicode stuff. It was just something they created themselves. And then that became popular on that carrier. And then the other carriers adopted it but made their own kind of modifications. And so for a few years, there was like 3 versions of the emoji characters that were all sort of incompatible. And then it became like a part of the extended Unicode thing, but wasn't fully adopted until 2010. But Apple added it, I think, in 2008 when they were on the iPhone in Japan, and then brought it to all iPhones in 2009. In case you can't tell, I had to write a history of emoji about.
I asked the right person. I'm gonna tell you. Wow.
So I had to learn all this because I had to figure out really like who decides on Unicode standards, and I had to go through all. Anyway, I learned way more about the Unicode process than I ever wanted to, but I also learned about emoji. But yeah, I mean, it basically came from someone really smart at a phone carrier who they were trying to create a differentiated way of people to communicate. And Japan is the perfect place for this, right? Because you've got, you know, it's very difficult for people to text characters mean different things in different contexts. So pictographs are a much easier way to get a message across than trying to use a soft keyboard or to type things in, especially on like, you know, a flip phone. So creating those characters was a huge boon, and it just took off. And people just kind of, I mean, that's kind of the beauty of it, is that it can kind of be applied to almost anything.
So the new Unicode, which was announced a couple of months ago, has 250 emojis in the Unicode, is now it's officially part of the character set. Are those the canonical, I can't even believe I'm going to use this phrase, canonical emojis that...
Yes.
Yes. There's a standard.
So So there have already been a couple hundred emojis that we've been using for the last few years that are available. And then Unicode approved another, I think, 300, and it'll be up to each individual company. So, you know, Apple will make their approval, Android, you know, Microsoft, whoever, to adopt what they want.
And Christina, you know, Apple, will they be more ethnically diverse now? Because we had a lack of ethnic diversity. Yeah.
Well, they are a little bit better with that, but the problem was...
What ethnicity are those smiley faces? Those are not...
No.
But then there are things like man holding man's hand, man holding woman's hand, and there are other faces where things are not as... Okay. And the thing is that all Unicode does is describe the pictograph and have a basic drawing of how it could be portrayed, but it could be drawn in any way. The problem is they didn't fully solve the diversity complaints because... The most current version of the Unicode standard went into discussions a few years ago. So all the problems that were brought up recently was basically after, you know, it was too late to get it into this round. But what companies like Apple and Twitter and Facebook and other people who have their own emoji libraries can do is they can maybe try to draw them to be more diverse.
Well, but, let's look at the pile of poo, shall we?
Yes, the pile of poo is the best.
But what's interesting is Google's pile of poo doesn't have a face on it, but Apple's does.
Yes. So Apple's...
Microsoft declined to put a face on the pile of poo, but Twitter not only has a face, but apparently a happy face.
A happy face. He has a mouth, yeah. I mean, that's kind of the interesting thing about emoji, too, is depending on what your device you're on, depends on what, you know, it looks like. Apple's have been drawn fairly closely to what... kind of the original
the Japanese standard, I guess. Yeah.
Right, and they've kind of carried that on, and most people who ape kind of the thing follow that line, but Google obviously has its own design. It's kind of Android-based. Twitter made the decision to draw its own. What's interesting is that the Chrome browser actually doesn't display emoji, which is messed up and
it doesn't.
Annoying.
I'm on some pages, and I'm getting boxes on the Wikipedia.
Exactly, and it's annoying because even if you have an emoji font library installed in Windows or in OS X, it won't pull it in. Firefox put in a patch that if as long as you have an emoji font installed on your system, it'll use the system font. Apparently, something's coming for the next Canary version of Chrome. I don't know. I find it ironic only because Google was the very first company to push for emoji to be part of the Unicode standard, yet they're like the last browser maker that actually supports emoji inline. But hey.
Do you think there's going to be a war among differing emoji interpretations? For instance... from the, believe it or not, Unicode.org site.
Yes.
An example of different lollipops.
Yep.
And these are all considered compliant.
Yep.
But they can be black and white. They can be color. As you saw, the poo is smiling in Apple's world, but steaming in Google's world. It just, there's really some variation.
Yeah, I mean, I guess it could kind of become like different dialects, you know, I mean, different type of pigeon. Because, I mean, that's really what most people compare kind
it's
of emoji
a pigeon.
To. It's a pigeon, exactly.
It's a pigeon. Wow. What do you think of this, Jerry? Is this crazy?
Well, it strikes me as setting the art of writing back about 2,000 years.
Literally.
Yeah,
I mean, we're going
true.
To
that's
higher
literally.
Erotic writing, aren't we?
Yes.
We are.
How does that
mean? We'll do again.
Not phonetics. That's, of course, what our public schools have been trying to do to the English language for the last 50 years. And they've been so successful that the literacy rate of the United States is about that of pre-war Iraq. But
Well, what's interesting is now kids are, I think, maybe their literacy in emojis is higher than their literacy in English.
Well, but...
Is it as expressive, do you feel...
Leo, I have in my collection of stuff that I think to write about a pile of newspapers written in pidgin.
Really?
Yes, pidgin English. You know, father belong you and me, belong you me.
Wow.
You.
Are they? Where are they from?
The New Scotland.
New Scotland.
That's an official language there. They conduct elections in it, and they have newspapers printed in it. The problem is that there's only about 900 words in the language.
Well, there's only 700-some emojis, so that is a fairly constrained Chinese ideographs. There's hundreds of thousands.
You're going to have a hell of a job writing a decent novel in 900 words.
Yeah.
I don't know how many words are in Yiddish, but that's another example of a language that evolved from essentially people who didn't necessarily have formal training. These languages evolve, and even English.
And you ever had it built on a language that already existed around it, didn't it? Right. Of course, did Pidgin. But
right. Yeah. Emojis, I guess, although, there's some cultural biases. You mentioned, Christina, this is one of the emojis is a Tanabata tree, which wouldn't mean anything to anybody who's not in Japan. It's a kind of bamboo where they hang good wishes on it. There's the moon viewing ceremony, which, again, is something exclusively Japanese. So there's a lot of Japanese-only emojis.
Yeah, no, that's what's interesting is it's like moving forward, it seems like because the Unicode space can have extra characters depending on what country it's in, is that they're already kind of anticipating different countries having their own kind of cultural emojis maybe. So you might have different, like the first biggest request was actually for more flags. They wanted more country flags. People really wanted to be able to show their national pride. Right. And I think maybe beyond that, you might start to see some very specific things to what's happening.
Can you communicate? Could you effectively communicate among two people who speak different spoken languages using emojis? Would it be how efficient would it be? How good would it be? How detailed would it be?
That's a really interesting point. I was actually thinking that. I was thinking that would actually be, I think, a really interesting, like, honestly, genuinely, like, I think that would be an interesting academic study to look at how people could communicate using, I guess it'd be the same as any sort of pictograph, but if you could use maybe that mixed with some other things to talk with someone when there's a language barrier.
I didn't realize what a difference there is in how the emojis are rendered. That moon ceremony. Apple does it in a very detailed, very pretty fashion, but Google does it in a more stylized, and I kind of like it a better fashion than Twitter has its own thing. You could tell they're the same emoji, but there's definitely a variation in how it's expressed. I think this is fascinating. I don't know what to make of it, but isn't this how new languages emerge?
It totally is. And I guarantee you in like 5 years' time, there are going to be so many academic like PhD thesis on emoji and linguistics study. Like there are going to be so many linguistic papers about emoji. But they're already in progress right now.
Have you spent enough time again?
Aren't you really just facilitating illiteracy?
No, it's a different kind of literacy, Jerry. It's a different kind.
How many haikus are you going to write in emojis?
Well, I don't think it's not going to eliminate English, but I think there might be a place for it.
Well, Mr. Heinlein, I got an email from a reader who's watching this, and he points out that Mr. Heinlein predicted way back in one of his older novels that a computer reading of texts and everything would reduce a lot of the country to illiteracy. And, of course, that was the novel that had abandoned areas in it, which is pretty close to what we have in some cities now.
I listen to audiobooks and love audiobooks. I listen to your books. I don't think that's illiterate.
No. No, I mean, if you're doing it as an addition, too, that's fine.
I can read, but I like to listen. And, our friend Trey Ratcliffe, photographer Trey Ratcliffe, has been saying for some time that thanks to the popularity of Instagram and other similar platforms among younger people, that the visual image is rapidly becoming the preferred form of communication. Look at Snapchat, which has some text, but really is mostly about the image. Instagram is all about the image. I think that's very interesting.
No, I do too. I have a lot of friends who are hearing impaired, and so it's sort of interesting in that context when you look at whether it's ASL or BSL or any of the various variations of sign language, which are all different, by the way, which is another really interesting thing.
Yes,
the way that you can kind of get messages across, and that's actually one way where I think emoji does become interesting. Not maybe with people who speak different languages, whether it's English and Spanish, but with friends of mine who are hearing impaired, we do communicate a lot in emoji because as well as text things.
Interesting.
And you get the same sort of message across. And they FaceTime with people all the time. I mean, that's the easiest way
because they can
sign. It's
just
to FaceTime and sign. Yeah, because you can sign. But to do other things, where you can just kind of get a message across. It's a good way to just kind of have a shorthand. I agree with Jerry's point. You definitely could be the death of literacy, but I think that, I don't know. I feel like it's if language evolves, that's what happens. Language evolves, and I don't know if it's going to evolve into a digital form or pictographs and really be, I guess, devolve as it were or not. But it's interesting how just in a few years it's been able to kind of really take on steam.
I don't worry about that so much, Jerry, because I think the human urge to communicate nuance won't go away, right?
Right. And if you look, we've had television, right, for 60 years. And
people thought that would kill literacy.
Yes, and people thought comic books would kill books and paperbacks would kill hardbacks and, somehow destroy literacy. I don't worry about it. I mean, as long as we have a decent education system. Well, there's a big problem.
We don't have a decent education system.
That is a problem. I agree.
That's, by the way, a local problem here in the United States, particularly.
I think liberals and conservatives can all agree.
Not entirely local. Can I put in a plug for my newest book?
Yes.
Sure.
I have just put up on Amazon. It's not mine. I found the 1914 California sixth grade reader. And I added some comments to it. It's all public domain stuff, of course. The comments aren't. And it had some pretty good introductory materials by the people who had prepared it. So I've put it all together, and it's up on Amazon.
Oh, I'm going to buy it. How interesting.
California sixth grade reader is what it's called.
We actually have it. I live with a sixth grader. I'll see if he can read any of it.
Mm. That's it.
Yeah.
Right there.
Very interesting. What a good idea, Jerry. I think this is a whole new area for you.
There's a long story attached to it. I had it and talked about it in my columns, and some of my readers, this is back before scanning, actually typed the whole darn thing in so that I could put it up.
I don't know if I can read this.
By the time they got it done,
look at this.
I got that brain cancer, and it delayed doing anything for a long time.
I'm glad you've really... It's on Amazon.
I just got around to finishing it with the help of a lot of friends and advisors and a whole bunch of people there in the acknowledgments. But
this is sixth grade. This blows me away.
I'm putting it up in the hopes that homeschoolers will find it useful.
This I would consider, I have a tale of heroes who sailed away into a distant land to win themselves renown forever in the invention of the Golden Fleece. Whither they sailed, I cannot clearly tell. It all happened so long ago, it has all grown. This is wild. The old Greeks said it hung in Colchis, nailed to a beech
tree. And there was a time, Leo, when every literate person in the United States would have read the stories that are in that book.
Well, I'll grant you that we are not in that time anymore. This is well beyond, I would say.
Okay, but wait. We are in a time in which half the population is likely to be useless. That is, they are not able to do anything that any rational person would pay them money to do.
That's why it's a service economy.
Well, but what service can they perform?
Well, there's always a service.
If you can look at icons, you can work at McDonald's. You don't need to read.
But you do understand that much of what goes on at McDonald's is easily automated, and if you decide to pay a minimum wage of $15 an hour to the person who works at McDonald's, you basically have, in this era of cheap capital borrowing, you have taken away a decision from the McDonald's franchise owner.
I remember when McDonald's converted their cash registers to icons.
Exactly right.
And you don't have to make change anymore because it tells you what the change is.
It makes it automatically, yeah.
Plus, they encourage customers to use debit or credit card, so you don't even have to handle money.
Right.
If they're using or their phone someday.
All right. We're going to stop because I'm getting depressed. And I don't know. We went down an emoji rabbit hole, but it was kind of interesting, frankly. I find this stuff fascinating. We do know, according to 9 to 5 Mac, Mark Gurman, who's pretty good on this stuff, Apple will announce the new iPhone probably the second or third week in September. No surprise there. Christina, you agree, unlikely to see anything but a 4.7-inch iPhone. That would be a big step for Apple.
That would be, to me, that seems like that's as big
as...
That's enough. I mean, 5.5, I know a lot of people are buying the phablets and they're really popular, but that goes against so many of Apple's own, kind of design cues. And I think most people, I think, are going to be satisfied with that. So, I don't see a 5.5-inch iPhone coming. I really don't.
You agree, Larry?
I will go public. Well, but
I'm with you on that. You and I are the only two, by the way, Christina.
I think iPhone users will be happy enough with the difference that they will go ahead and buy the new iPhone. I don't think they're going to win away a lot of customers who already have larger Android phones, unless they offer some other great features that we're not seeing on Android. But I think to keep the iPhone users happy, sure, that'll be fine.
And whither, if I might use a word I learned from the 1914 reader, whither the iPad? I presume an October announcement for an iPad, maybe an iWatch. What could they do in the iPad that would make it compelling? A fingerprint reader is the only thing missing.
Yeah, Touch ID. Touch ID is, I mean, right now, personally, I think that the iPad Air is, I love it. It's my favorite tablet that I own.
Perfect.
Yeah, it's, to me, I don't know how you could physically design it to be any better, except for a Touch ID sensor.
Maybe an A8 or something, a faster
process.
Right,
I mean, you can make some, but as far as the industrial design, like, this to me feels like, you know, the pinnacle. It feels like when they, you know, reined in on the current MacBook Air thing and the, you know, when they got the unibody Mac down, like, you kind of get down to, like, the pinnacle of design. So,
you know,
I don't know.
You think about the other things that we own, right? Like every year, do you go out and see what's the latest refrigerator because I want to upgrade my refrigerator?
Yes, exactly. Or
I've had my high def TV now for 5 years, and it was a 1080p and it had 4 HDMI ports, and I have absolutely no interest in buying a new one.
Well,
and,
thanks to you, the entire television industry is
exactly.
Dying.
Well, I think the tablet the same. You love your MacBook Air. You're going to love it a year from now, and it's going to be just as good a year from now, better actually, because there'll be a new iOS out, hopefully.
Mm-hmm.
And in a way, Apple's created its own problem by doing such a great job. But if they didn't do a great job, then they'd be in worse trouble than they're in now. Well, actually, they're not in trouble. They'd be in trouble.
Right.
So, you know, they just have to come up with new product categories and hope we love the iWatch or whatever it is they do come out with finally.
And I think the industry as a whole has to come up to the expectation that if you're going to be spending more than $400 on a tablet, it's something that you keep for X number of years versus replacing, you know, every year or every 2 years like you do with a phone.
Because
you don't have the same wear and tear with the tablet that you do with a phone. And as you said, I mean, you know, most people it works great for them year after year, so they don't feel a need to upgrade. But I think if the expectations are in line, then, you know, it proves it can be a viable business, but it's just not going to be as big as the phone.
Oh, you'll have to excuse me. Kim Kardashian is calling me right now. Hey, it's Kim. I wanted to let you know you're all set to come by the shoot.
Yep.
See, this is why you need a bigger iPad.
Yep. I won't lie. I've paid money for that game.
Well, who is the writer who spent $400 in the game?
Somebody from Gizmodo. And I'm kind of jealous she wrote that post because I like 2.5 weeks before she did that, I downloaded it like the week it became huge, ironically. And then I wound up blowing like $20 or $30 on it. And I thought about, should I write anything about this? And it wasn't getting a lot of mainstream buzz. I was too early. This is always my problem. I'm always too early. And if I had just gone for it, I could have been like the first one on the block.
You
to,
could
like,
have
talk
been
about the craziness.
Shamed in public.
Oh, but I shamed myself. I mean, I mean, come on. If you spend money, it's design yourself, Leo. Like
buy
it,
now.
No, design Chad. Yeah, it's so good.
So let's,
I made myself Christina with
here.
A K.
Uh-huh. Yeah, that's how we know you're hip and with it. This is so funny. Everything's with a K. Customized with a K, right?
Well, exactly. So I named my own character Christina with a KH, which I thought was funny. I thought that was fitting. So I did create my own character.
The story is fascinating. This company, Glue, actually developed this program as a separate program. And they released it, and it was a success. But then what did they – did Kim Kardashian come calling? What happened?
I mean, they basically, you know, said, okay, well, we can license it. They jiggered a few things, and it's basically – I think it was called their
the
Starbucks game or something. It's the exact same game.
Yeah.
They just reskinned it. She got a big paycheck out of it, and something about her appeal, and I think, honestly, the fact that the public both loves and hates her with equal interest – here's the real secret. The game is actually really well done.
It's pretty good.
Getting people to pay more money. It's a really good, this type of game. Like, it's a really good, you know, the grinding is addictive enough that you want to pay. The in-app purchases are, you know, they come in enough that you really kind of want to go through the process. So they've got all the mechanics down. And so if you add that with, a public figure who most of the world both loves or hates, and I'm in the latter category. Like
I'm going to call myself
every single day
K Chief K Wit.
There you go.
Gotta have
there
a K, right?
Yep. But I mean, like I personally
Kim
every single day. Yes.
I picked that outfit out for her.
It's great.
Jerry, you're worried about literacy, and this is happening.
This is what the real, this is the real threat to literacy right here is the Kardashians. Well, the
you could be reading a book.
In $500 million. I agree.
Well,
we could be reading Valley of the Dolls, and that's what we should be reading.
This would be
instead
an upgrade,
of, you know.
You have to understand something, Leo.
Yeah?
I don't need everybody in the United States to buy one of my books. I just need $1 million a year to pay me $1.
Ah, you see, so while the rest of us are playing with Kim Kardashian, as long as a few of you are buying Jerry's books, all will be well.
Yeah, well, not only that, but the people who don't have anything else to do have got to do something. Nobody will pay you much money to do that, but now, at least it beats your being out robbing stores.
The new thing is, and Christina, I bet you do this, you're watching TV or listening to a book while you're doing it.
Yep.
Yep. So it's not that you're doing this all by itself, by no means.
Hey, Leo, you're making TV while you're doing it.
What are you talking about?
You're actually on the air right now, buddy.
I'm doing a show, and I'm keeping up with the Kardashians.
Exactly. Yeah, exactly. See, this is the passive. You know, you're talking earlier about how you know the passive, focus about how your best ideas come in the shower. I play Candy Crush or Bejeweled or Threes or other games while I'm in meetings, and I have to explain to people going in, I'm not being rude. I'm actually completely 100% paying attention to you, but I will actually be able to focus on what you're saying better if my hands are busy.
How's that working out for you?
I thought you were going to tell me you had a water-resistant iPad that you play games in the shower.
Do they buy that, Christina? Because I want to use that excuse. Really?
You know why they do? Because it's true. Because then they'll call me on something and I'll pipe up. I'm not really paying deep attention to the game.
No.
It's one of those things that is taking my subconscious attention. It's taking the attention to that, and I can focus on what's happening elsewhere. But my hands need to be busy. And I've been like that as long as I was a kid. I used to get in trouble. And
it's ADD.
It's like if she wasn't doing that, she'd have to be taking Ritalin.
I think that's exactly right, Jerry. I think it's ADD, ADD. Those of us who are ADD, and many, 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 many people in this industry are ADD.
That's right.
So what the deal is, and I found out because I investigated this for myself, is our frontal lobe is depressed. It's not moving as fast as you normal people.
Precisely.
So we need to stimulate it just to keep it at a normal level. So you could hit yourself in the head, or you could play the Kim Kardashian game. It's about the same.
Basically, no, and actually the person, when I figured this out when I was really young and when I told my shrink about this a number of years ago, it was just, speaking of TMI, yes, I my shrink, and he thought it was a great idea. No, but he thought it was brilliant. He was like, oh, I'm really glad you've come up with that, you know, sort of solution. And I didn't realize it was a solution. It was just something that I intrinsically did to kind of, I guess, you know, figure out how to better manage stuff. But that's exactly right. It's because we're ADD, and it's just one of those things that I concentrate way better if I'm just mindlessly tapping on the screen.
So here's the question I have. Are ADD people naturally attracted to tech and to this, or, and I think there might be some evidence for it, is all of this stimulus making us all a little bit attention deficit? What do you think, Jerry?
I think that you're getting closer when you say that. There is just a lot more distraction now than there used to be. I haven't seriously done psychology practice since the early 70s when I was partnered with a pediatrician in Los Angeles. And the only cases I ever took were what we described as bright kids who weren't doing well.
Yeah, that's
now,
me. That's
Christina. In those days, nobody had ever heard of ADD and AD&D. And ADHD and all the other literate things. And in my graduate school work in psychology, when I got my doctorate, I think we spent 2 days on autism in 4 years. So we had to come up with things. I would love to have had that Kardashian game to prescribe to some of those kids in those times.
It's better than Ritalin.
The big problem, the problem with drugs is you are not learning to control yourself. You are not learning it.
I had to deal with it because there was
a bright kid. Yeah. You're not doing him any favors by giving him Ritalin.
I was distracted and they didn't have that diagnosis when I was a kid. But I learned to play chess and do stuff that helped me focus. And I bet Christina, you did the same thing. Were you undiagnosed as a kid?
No, I was diagnosed.
Didn't we all? I mean, come on. Isn't that the case of almost everybody listening to this show?
If you're smart, you're bored.
Totally. And I always, like you, I mean, I came up with other ways to do things. And I was always a high achiever. So I didn't fit the perfect mold where, you know, you have the really bright kid who's not doing well because I'm also kind of OCD and a perfectionist.
So you made sure you did do well.
Yeah. Right. But I would find myself kind of, you know, I would find a way to, you know, entertain myself in boredom moments or get moved to, you know, a different class.
Well,
or
you did what Larry said.
You learned how to have a lot more choices as entertainment than people. I mean, when I'm growing up, I'm that age during World War II in Capelville, Tennessee. There's nothing. There's no television.
You had puppet
shows.
There's not
much on radio. I did get to read the Encyclopedia Britannica.
There you go. I did that too.
To make nitroglycerin, which wasn't anything that pleased my parents.
Folks, we refer you to the triangulation with Jerry Purnell, which he talks about blowing up the fish pond.
Luckily, Homeland Security wasn't around
another
at the time.
Time.
No, we talked about it on the show. No. Yeah, exactly.
No, honestly, I mean, one of the reasons I know as much about random things as I do is because I read a lot, and that was what I picked up as a kid. I read voraciously, and I would get interested in a topic, and I would read everything I could about it. And when I got interested in computers when I was 12, that was literally I went to the library and I got every book, every magazine that I could get, and just, you know, started obsessing and never stopped. So yeah, I do agree. I do worry a little bit. Maybe kids are too distracted by some of this stuff. As much as I love it from maybe reading, but there's, I think, a good balance that could be made. And there's definitely, I think, an opportunity for, you know, educators to make, you know, interesting, you know, games or learning aids that could really kind of, you know, bring.
While we're on this topic, let me point out that there I am in Capelville, Tennessee, but the books we're reading in school were things like that California sixth grade reader. We had Jason and the Argonauts. We had Horatius at the Bridge. We had Under the Spreading Chestnut Tree, the Village Smithies, and so forth. We had a great deal more intellectually stimulating stories in our classrooms than they are teaching in any classroom I know of in the public school system today.
Let me put in an optimistic word for at least some educators in some connected learning classrooms where kids, whatever amount of information they're consuming, they're actually also creating information. And whether it's posting videos to YouTubes or blogging or even polishing up their Facebook or Twitter accounts, there is a great deal of creativity and interactivity and connected learning going on. And in many ways, it's a resurgence. Jerry, I'm not quite as old as you are, but I remember the 60s. I ran a program at Berkeley called the Center for Participant Education, where we did student-initiated courses and student-centered learning. And that's actually making a comeback now, partially because of technology and partially because there are some really great teachers out there who, despite their bosses, are doing amazing things with technology.
And
kids are being creative.
But you, Larry, you just said it, despite their bosses. The purpose of the public school system is to pay bad teachers.
Well, and there's also
if
some great
any,
teachers,
if
too.
Kids show up some teacher as a bad teacher, the system is designed to suppress that kid.
Well, but that was true when I was a kid. I mean, I had probably 18 years of bad, well, I had 12 years of bad teachers, you know, through K-12. One or two exceptions.
I bet you everybody who listens to this show, everybody who's a Twit fan, is very much like us, where they were smart kids. They perhaps would like Christina and OCD, or perhaps like me, we're always told, you have such potential.
Exactly.
You never too. Live up to your potential.
God, Leo, you and I go to the same school. I heard the same thing.
Of course we did. I think that probably 90% of the people who listen to these shows, who are tech buffs, who are interested in this stuff, who are all smart because... you need to have some intelligence to understand this and to delve into it. Probably dealt with the same thing. But the good news to me is we all adapted. We all found a way. Definitely. Humans are amazingly adaptive. And even if teachers are bad, it's nice if you get one great teacher. I think it's all any human can expect in life is one great teacher. If you get that,
an administrator whose job it is to suppress the great teacher.
Well, the other thing is, I hate to admit it, but being ADD is really a great credential for being on live radio.
completely agree.
There's something to be said for being able to make
something. I can handle stuff. Yeah. I've got people in my ear. I've got things going on. I just walked. I just took a walk around the block while you were talking. So I keep in. Hey, we're going to take a break. I want to come back. Well, I got to talk about shaving for a moment, if you don't mind. By the way, as always, when you get smart, interesting people together, you end up talking about such wide-ranging, fascinating things. I just want to thank you three. Jerry Pournelle, Larry Magid, Christina Warren. It's always a pleasure to have the three of you on.
I'm waiting to figure out what you're going to call this show.
I think Smartphone Scabbard right now is the leading contender.
That's good.
I want one. Our show today brought to you by Harry's. I just, you know, it's fascinating what Harry's has been doing. It was founded about a year ago by two guys, Andy and Jeff. You may know Jeff because he was also the co-founder of Warby Parker. In fact, there's some similarities. Jeff looked at what was going on in the eyeglasses industry and realized people weren't getting fair prices because of monopoly and so forth. It's the same thing in razors. I mean, what do you pay for a Fusion blade? Like $4. So they're so valuable now, they lock them up in the drugstore. Jeff said, there's a way to make a better blade for less to give people what they want. And he created Harry's. And this is the fascinating thing. I just found this out. They went to Germany. There's two factories in all the world that can make a razor blade that doesn't cut you up when you shave. They bought one in Germany. This is where they make their blades. One of the two factories in the world that knows how to do this. And they bought it because they wanted to make great blades. And I think that our audience is smart enough. Most of the world will go out and they'll use disposable razors and their face will get cut up. And the next morning they'll forget the whole thing and they'll do it again. Or there are people who will pay $4 for a Gillette Fusion or whatever because they want something better. Believe me, there's something much better, and it's Harry's. They focus on giving you a great shaving experience at a fraction of the price. I have every other month I get my Sherry's kit. I get, I think, 8 blades and 2 shaving creams. By the way, the Sherry shaving cream they sell is phenomenal. You can get the Winston, which is the metal blade, or the Truman, which is the plastic blade. This is a Winston. I got mine engraved with my initials, of course. And Jeff Needles, my initials are L-E-O. He gave me a hard time because he says, your initials are not L-E-O. Well, that's what I use for my initials. Beautiful, nice handle. This incredible blade. It's a combination of that plus the amazing shaving cream that makes Harry's such a experience every morning you're going to look forward to. I want you to try it. Simple, clean product design at a really great price. Shipped to your door. You're going to try it, right? You're going to go to harrys.com right now. And when you do, please use the offer code TWIT5. You'll get $5 off your first order at harrys.com. They have reinvented shaving. And that's for the ladies, too, by the way. Don't feel like you can't. It could be Harriet.
Oh.
Oh, Harry's.
Now, my wife asked about that with her, because we went out and bought one a couple weeks ago. I bought one, and she wanted to know whether there was a female version. And so you're saying the male version will work with women.
Yeah, we've tried to talk him into doing a pink one, but I don't
know. No, they should. No, they could make a killing because we spend just as much on our razors as men do. I've used Harry's, and works great for women, too. And
I'm a big fan.
So much cheaper than having to go to the drugstore. And you get great quality. That's the nice thing.
You actually start to like get shaving in the morning, which is something I did not do for most of my life. I look forward to it now. Please.
Well, you don't have to worry about going to buy anything.
That's also good.
Like,
oh,
yes.
It's also good.
I love the fact that there's so many things now that I don't have to go.
I know. Right? I don't leave the house. I know. We have Safeway delivers stuff, Amazon Subscribe and Save. In fact, I always look for more stuff I can put on Subscribe and Save.
I'm doing an article called, How Tech is Allowing Me to Be Rich, even though I'm not only am I not in the Forbes 400. If they had a Forbes for a million, I'm sure I wouldn't be in it either. But I have a private chauffeur if I use Uber. I have a personal shopper if I use Google Express. Yeah. I've got private chefs now through Munchery. It's like, hey, I feel like a millionaire.
That's the future for the economy. There's the future economy, right? There's jobs for all of those people.
There's jobs and there's lower costs. Well, decent products for a fair price,
right,
which is nice.
Public beta for Apple's Yosemite came out this week. I can tell you right now, despite all the warnings from everybody, including Apple, to not put it on a production machine, to back up all your data. You can't even install it when you try to install it. It says, you backed up, right?
Yeah.
I didn't do any of that stuff. And it's fine. It works great. I love it. I can't tell you much about it because unless you're using iOS 8, you know, many of the features like continuity don't do anything. But for what I've seen, its design is nice. I think this is, and it's very stable now. I think it's probably very close to being ready to ship.
Funny, Lou, I actually advise people not to install
it. Of course, because you're responsible. Yeah.
I only have one app. I only have one Mac. If it were a PC, I'd put it on one of my spare machines. But I have a MacBook Air that I actually use, and I didn't want to take the chance. But maybe I will now that you've had good chance.
I haven't had any problems. Now, I'm using a Mac Pro. It's late model.
Yeah.
But I haven't had any problems with it. The only, one thing, OpenPGP doesn't work with it. That's all.
If you can, Larry, if you have an external drive, you can install it on and just use it as a secondary partition. That's what I would do it on. It's really stable, but the problem is that some of the third-party apps aren't quite there.
Right.
And so if there might be like one app that you don't know until you get it on that it's not going to work. So what I've done, I have a testing machine at work, but then for my personal use, I've actually got it running on a USB 3 drive.
Have you run into any apps that don't work?
There have been a couple of third-party apps that just I've had some issues with them not wanting to work exactly correct. And some of the developers have been really quick on fixing them. But, you know, I mean, it just kind of – when that's going to get sorted out,
is
it's going to depend
on the developer.
Is this the
first time Apple's done a public beta? I mean, Microsoft always does. And I can't remember them doing one.
Yes. Yeah, this is the first time since the original developer preview for OS X was released in the year 2000.
The very first OS X.
Right, and that was released, like you paid $30 and you got a DVD or a CD in the mail. So this is the first time they've done this. And I think it's two things. One, I think that it shows that they're confident. You know, as you were saying, Leo, it feels right. I think that this shows confidence in their product, that they feel like we can open this up to a million people and have, you know, people test it out. But the second thing is I think that they really want to make sure that before they release the final version, that any bugs or any things they might be overlooking get fixed. Because when Mavericks came out, there was an issue with Gmail and Mail.app. I didn't have the problem, but a ton of people did. And I know that the guys at Tidbits wrote a ton of really good stuff about it. And Apple fixed it fairly quickly. But I have a feeling they want to avoid having those sorts of issues pop up again. And I think that's great. You know, I mean, I think that's one of the best things that Microsoft's done.
Microsoft always have millions of beta testers, and they still have bugs.
We should say Windows has had a public beta for the last two versions.
Yes, they have. Yeah. Yes, they have.
And lots and lots of people used it.
And it didn't matter.
Still
no, but I mean,
didn't any of those people say, hey, this Windows 8 thing, bad idea?
Well,
not one.
They had a lot of testimonials of people who claimed to love it. They had videos galore.
Can we now officially say that Windows 8 sucks?
You can't say Microsoft sucks. Acknowledged that.
You like your Jerry, you like 8?
No, but 8.1 isn't all that bad.
It fixes a lot.
What an endorsement. 8.1, not all that bad. Microsoft should put that on billboards.
My main machine still runs 7, so don't...
I think it's fair to say that Windows 8 got Steve Ballmer fired from his job as CEO, got a great many people, including the guy behind it, Steven Sinofsky, fired. I think that you can say, looking at Microsoft's results... that it cost them billions of dollars in upgrades. I can't think of a bigger failure except maybe New Coke.
Vista.
No, this is worse than Vista. This is worse than Vista.
The timing of this is way worse.
There are some pieces of it that are, in fact, fairly good, but they could have been grafted onto 7 without much difficulty.
No, I think it's certainly better in many ways. They fixed file copying and stuff. But what they did with the user interface is... an abomination. I mean, really, really bad.
Well, let me, Leo, again, my experience with 8 was pretty miserable until I got this session and started updating everything to, like, Office 365.
Yeah.
And, boy, that is better.
I do like Office 365. I've been very happy with
it. It sets up better. Outlook actually is almost a pleasure to get it running now.
Almost
a pleasure. There are a number of things that I used to dread. I mean, I didn't want to put Outlook on a new machine.
I loathe Outlook.
I better sharpen pencils or carry the garbage out rather than do that. Like sitting down to write a novel, there's always something that's easier to do. But I bit the bullet, and yesterday we put Outlook on 4 machines, and it only took an hour for all 4 of them.
So I run Windows 8
that's
on my...
that's 365.
Right.
I mean, Office 365.
No, they've licked... I have to say, this is one thing Microsoft does well. And what, yes. You know what? The future for Microsoft is very clear. It's in the cloud. It's cloud services. Mm-hmm. It's enterprise. I know Microsoft doesn't want to be IBM, but this is the one thing they really still do well, right?
It is. I mean, you know, I think that they lost a lot of ground by being so hesitant to go the cloud route with Office for so long.
Right.
You know, I think that if 365 had come out earlier or at least some iteration of that, so many places wouldn't have gone to Google Docs, because I would still, even though I write almost everything in a text editor, you know, I'm one of those, I guess, new old school people, and I write everything in Markdown. So I write everything in a text editor. Yeah. I've done that for years, but you know, I would much use Word than Google Docs. I would definitely rather use Excel than Google Spreadsheet. And with 365 having a way to save it, it's great.
So I use Windows 8.1 on my production machine, and the first thing I did is I put this alternative start menu
right.
on. So
yes,
it
I
looks
did too.
Like Windows
yes.
7.
Of course. What else
and
are you
then
gonna do? Yeah.
I threw away Windows 365 and replaced it with an old copy of Windows 2010
Office,
because it. Office 2010, I'm sorry, that's what I meant to say. Yeah, Word, mostly Word, but Excel, because it works just fine. It's lean. There's no reason for me to have to pay an annual membership fee, because the 3-year-old and 5-year-old and 2-year-old versions of Office work just fine for what I do. And I think Microsoft has the same problem Apple has.
On the other hand, I got 5 stations plus 5 things like the tablets.
Yeah.
For $100 a year.
No, that's a good deal.
Yeah, no, it's a good deal. It's not a bad deal.
I'm going to pay that one way or another. Now, I have an unlimited copies of everything up through Windows 2007, because Microsoft used to just give me an unlimited license to all of them.
Sure.
I haven't been writing the column since then, so I haven't I haven't felt I ought to ask for that kind of extension nowadays. But no, one of the problems with making a profit in this business is that a lot of stuff just works and works forever.
I
haven't
like
upgraded anything of my stuff for a couple of years because it's always been good enough. I didn't need to. That's kind of the subject of my next column is, it turns out sometimes it's worth upgrading. But you don't have to.
All right, next.
You yourself pointed out George Martin has written
on WordStar.
On WordStar, for God's sake. Now, I wouldn't do that.
He still knows all the dot commands.
I've been using Microsoft Word ever since Chris Peters came down and asked us what we wanted to see in it. So
I still use the WordStar Diamond in Microsoft Word because I like the fact that I can navigate without taking my hands off the home row of keys. So I still use Control X to go down and Control Y to go up, et cetera.
That's funny.
I had to hack it, but it wasn't hard to do.
A Tale of Two Selfies. This is one I really liked. It's from Mashable. Young kid, 16-year-old Tom White, lives in Omaha, Nebraska. He was walking down the street in Omaha just a couple of days ago when he spotted a couple of very famous people sitting on a bench. So instead of asking for an autograph, who was this? Was it you, Larry, said this is the new form of autograph?
That's
he
right,
turns
yeah.
around, takes it's a that. Selfie with Paul McCartney and Warren Buffett.
Happen to be sitting together, waiting for a bus.
That is one happy. What I'm impressed, by the way, that a 16-year-old knew who they were.
Maybe, so are we. That was the best part.
That's the best part, isn't it?
What was Paul McCartney doing there? With hanging out with
he was he's on tour. He was in Lincoln. Yeah.
Wow.
Oh, is it? Is it the Allen Conference coming up?
It was during the Sun Valley Conference. I think.
No,
it was,
this
that
is
was
Omaha.
Oh, okay, it was Omaha. Okay.
Yeah, this is Omaha. This is in the Sun Valley. This is something you don't see every day in Omaha.
So even more random. That's awesome.
It's totally random. They apparently had just come out after a lengthy evening of dinner and ice cream, and they were sitting on the bench digesting. And that happens a lot in Omaha. And Tom said, wait a minute. Now, that's the happy one. This is one that is a little bit more controversial. Princess Brianna Mitchell from Roanoke, Virginia, took a picture of herself at Auschwitz and posted this on Instagram saying, I'm famous, y'all.
Yeah.
Now, she's getting death threats. People feel like it's maybe I'm trying to find a better image here of it.
Go to larrysworld.com.
Oh, do you have it on Larry's World? Yeah, because you want to defend her, don't you?
I defended her. I
mean, I feel bad for her, but.
Yeah, there she is. Let's stop persecuting this girl.
Yeah. I mean, look, let's not give her death threats, but maybe her parents should have taught her.
Well,
maybe.
Actually, her dad, who unfortunately passed away, inspired this because her dad was going to take her to Auschwitz because she had studied it in her history class, and she was very interested in World War II. She's not an insensitive
kid. So she knew where she was and what she was doing.
She knew what she was doing. And look, we smile at cameras. Look, how many pictures do you think there are of the Alamo at Gettysburg?
I was going to say Gettysburg.
Ground Zero. I was at Ground Zero. I saw pictures of people taking pictures of themselves.
Yeah, oh, no, there are. And then we all... That's true. But, I mean, when we see people doing selfies at Ground Zero, I mean, I think a lot of us walk by in disgust. And whether it's fair or not, I mean, you make a really good point. And I didn't know that she had a good understanding of what was
there. That's what you think is you look at this and go, like Justin Bieber writing in the Anne Frank guest book.
Yeah. Right.
And that's where we go. And unfortunately, so many, you know, girls her age act that way without having the historical knowledge
because
they didn't know that it's easy for us to go that direction.
There are more fun places to go.
There definitely are. But I mean, I think that's good to know. I mean, I feel like that's the problem with social, right? Is that context a lot of times the full story is lost.
See, here's the problem. Is it in the social media world, it is so easy for us to shame people based on the little data we have about them to judge.
Yeah.
And again, I bet you if you were to look through every picture ever taken of me in my lifetime, you would probably find a picture of me in a battlefield smiling.
I'm judging you right now, Larry.
People died there, right?
I know for a fact that I've had pictures taken of me standing on Little Round Top, and I didn't look like I was being dejected.
Yeah.
For heaven's sake.
You're right.
Yeah.
It was a long time ago. But
I mean, I agree that this girl hopefully would learn a lesson, and other kids who are watching this show, because I'm sure millions of teenagers watch Twit, are learning a lesson to be careful about what you post in social media. But I think we also have to, as adults, be a little less judgmental, a little more understanding, and just say, okay, maybe you made a mistake, but let's not condemn you.
Okay, so Justin Bieber
goes
to the Anne Frank house, writes in the guest book.
So he's a different story. She's a regular girl. I'm with Larry on this. I don't understand why this even blew up and became a viral sensation because she's a minor. We shouldn't have ever, you know what I mean? Kids do things to me. I kind of feel weird about that. Now, Justin Bieber is now an adult, but back then he's famous, had a whole, you know, group of people. He's a little prick. And he wrote in the Anne Frank book,
Anne was a great girl. Hopefully she would have been a believer.
Oh, well, to begin with, that's incredibly narcissistic. Incredibly.
And you know what? Just so you know, Jerry, we can blame the Canadian education system for Justin Bieber. It's not our fault. He's Canadian.
It's so socialist. It's because they have free health care. That's the problem.
I do think, though, that there is a problem here, which is that the ability to judge quickly and destroy people has never been better. And we always have been judgmental. I mean, humans are judgmental. We're gossip mongers. But the fact that we have social media amplifies is so beyond anything we were able to do before. I do worry about that.
And Leo, I bet you have your share of trolls. I know I do. And, negative things to say about us.
Oh,
Christine,
yeah.
I'm sure you have some. Jerry, I'm even one of your trolls. What can I say?
Nobody trolls Jerry Pournelle.
I'm your fans.
No.
Well, not true, but
I'm sure you have trolls. We all do.
Larry's had the same problem. Leo has the same problem. I don't know. I haven't seen much in Christina, but
nobody trolls Christina Warren.
Nobody is all that popular.
There isn't
somebody out there hoping to punch you in the stomach and get a headline for doing it.
Yeah. See, here's the problem. So we're all professional journalists, and we go out there, we put ourselves
we're
out
public
there.
Figures. We're public figures.
If you're a kid on Twitter, you're also a public figure, but you're not a public figure, right? You're an ordinary kid, but now millions of people potentially are tuning in on you, and suddenly you're being held to the same standards and getting the same kind of ridicule that people like us who kind of knew what we signed up for have to put up with.
You know, Anil Dash wrote a great article on Medium about this very subject. What is public I'm afraid a little too nuanced probably for most people.
Exactly.
And I'm not sure how to summarize it, but essentially just because Twitter and Facebook are public technically doesn't mean that they should be public. It's public, for instance, and even legal to look in somebody's window as you walk by in the street. But more social mores say it's not to be done. And the problem is we don't have those mores on Twitter. He's blaming the media in some ways for this because they'll take tweets Of course, they're right when they say, hey, that you're tweeting, it's public.
Yeah.
But many things we do that we consider public have by social mores not been considered public. He says, for instance, if an addiction recovery group decides to take advantage of summer weather and meet in a park instead of their church basement, you can legally record the conversation and post it with photographs on the internet. You could tag the names of their employers, friends, and family members, but it would be wrong. It would be again, people, you know, it would be wrong.
I love
it. It would be wrong, but it's going to happen.
Now, I love to take pictures of people, but I will not take a picture of a person and do anything with it without their permission. And it's not legally required, right? I'm out in a public park and I see an interesting looking person. I'm not, and unless they're like a performer or something, I'm not going to take a picture of them without asking, especially a kid, simply because I think it's wrong, legal or not legal.
And I think, Jerry, you would agree with this. The answer is not to make laws, but to enforce already existing social mores on what is private.
Of course. Of course. Now, I unlike Larry, I do take pictures of people without their permission, but I don't publish them.
Yeah, well, that's
novelists need something to draw on, and every now and then people will be doing interesting things that will appear at some point as an incident in one of my stories, but you won't trace it to that person.
Right.
So that's really interesting. I'm sorry, a little sidetrack. So you will, as part of character research for writing, you will take a picture of somebody and say, I'm going to visualize that person as, let's say, Gil the Surfer or something like that. How interesting.
Yeah, I think many novelists do.
I love that. That's a little insight into the process that I love. That's fascinating.
My problem is that I would publish it, so I publish everything I do. I don't have a private life.
But praise to, and I recommend people go to Medium and read Anil Dash's article. It's nuanced.
He's such a good writer.
He is so great. And he is a good thinker. Which is,
Yeah, he is.
What is public, he says, is the title of it. It's so simple, right? But no, it's not. And I think this is a great discussion that needs to be, we need to have more often. Often, I think what a lot of people do, and I'll include myself sometimes, is say, there ought to be a law. But really, you know, social norms are so much more powerful. For instance, you have a lock on your front door, but really it's a simple thing to just kick that lock in and wander into your house. The lock has the force of course, of law, but also the force of social norms. You don't do that. You don't. And I think these are very powerful. And I think we ought to remember that and maybe encourage people.
You know, there's this whole thing about sexting and putting kids, literally putting them on sex offender registries, because technically if you sext and you're under 18, it's child pornography. But no. Come on, there are good reasons why it's generally a stupid idea. But that shouldn't be a crime.
No.
And the idea that somebody should be punished for it is just absurd.
Not merely punished, but essentially to be put on a registered sex offender list, which is
eternity.
Insane.
It's a life sentence.
I will point out that with regarding the publication of stuff, now I have taken pictures at things like Comdex where people were doing goofy things at booths that they probably shouldn't have been doing and didn't really want everybody to know they were doing. And I suppose one of them actually got fired as a result
of it. What was he doing?
But that's, I think, fair game. You're in public. You're out in public. You know you're in public.
Yeah. And you're an adult. Yeah.
What was he doing, Jerry? I want to know. He got fired for what?
I won't say which one, but it's one of the big outfits that basically... like Griffin, but it isn't Griffin. They sell accessories for this, that, and the other.
Yeah.
And the guy was making some really nasty jokes about his own product.
No.
It's dumb.
And I just didn't think he was doing it. Not only that, but it was funny. So I probably wouldn't do it again, but I did it. I was shocked when he was fired for it.
Sure.
And I'm kind of sorry. In a sense that I caused that, but I don't feel I've done anything wrong by publishing that picture. He was putting on a show for an audience.
Right. No, absolutely. I've taken pictures of somebody's walking in a parade, or you go to a festival and they're dressed in a particularly festive manner, and you want a picture of them. I think it's fine because, in a sense, they're performing in public anyway.
Yes.
But I wouldn't necessarily take a picture of just somebody standing there or a kid sucking their thumb. It came up when I was in Cuba. And there was this wonderful picture of this old man standing in a doorway, and it would have made a great picture. And I'm sure I could have taken it. He never would have known about it, and it would have been fine. But I just kind of felt bad. I just felt like I had no right to do that. And so I didn't
I think you and I are kind of in agreement about what the mores are. Yes.
The real problem, and I think we're all very aware of this, is that there's – I think this is another case of the drive to get clicks overpowering people's better angels.
I think, you know, this whole thing, you know, I write for Forbes, and they pay by the hit. And I don't like – I profit by that business model. I do very well because I get a lot of views. But I hate the idea of it. I hate the incentive.
And doesn't it incent you to create clickbait headlines?
It incents me to think very creatively about my headlines. And I try to do it with integrity. But I would have to – I would be lying to you if I didn't think about – the headlines a lot stronger than I used to think about headlines before I actually got paid for clicks.
Yeah.
And I just think it's – but, of course, that's always been true in publishing going back forever, right? Newspapers and headlines.
Well, forever. I mean, Pulitzer invented yellow journalism. I mean, when I made that remark in the Joseph Pulitzer building to a bunch of Columbia J School students at a panel I was on, I got really, really nasty looks. But I'm sorry, I actually know journalism history. You know, but Pulitzer and you know, Hearst, you know, that's their entire background was in yellow journalism, was in sensationalism, was in being a tabloid. But there's a fine line. And you know, I don't want to say it's any worse today than it's been before. What I do think, though, is that we have more access to regular people because everybody puts things out there that we don't always consider. And I've been guilty of it. My publication's been guilty of it. I think we've all kind of had those moments as we're talking about where you don't necessarily take into account this is what's happening. And this is a real person and maybe not someone who understands the significance of what's going on around them.
Right.
But the one good thing, the one only good thing I will say is that, you know, the news cycles are so short that you might get a lot of pressure if something like this goes national, but in 2 days, something else is going to, in most cases, you know, take everyone's attention away. That's the only good thing.
And the other thing is if anybody ever says something nasty about you on the web and it comes up in Google, all you have to do is be out there big time for another few weeks, and that will be so buried that when people Google you, that's going to be hundreds of hits down and you're going to be fine. So I always tell people, the more public you are, assuming that most of the things being said about you are positive, the safer you are in terms of your reputation being somehow damaged because of a search engine.
Well, this conversation has raised 2 points, which I want to get to in just a moment. One is the right to be forgotten, which is a story going on right now with Google, and the right in Europe anyway to say, I don't want search results to show up with my name. And the other is the how a company incents its employees, just as Forbes incents you, can affect the employee's behavior. Comcast has a little admission it wants to make regarding that customer service call with Ryan Block we talked about last week. Boy, that was the call heard around the world. Congratulations to Ryan for getting Comcast to think a little bit, but we'll talk about that in a second. I want to talk a little right now about one of our great sponsors, Atlassian. They make a product called Jira. You know about it. If you are a programmer, you work in a technology environment, you've surely heard of Jira. It lets you easily capture and organize your workflow, helps you prioritize, take action on what's important, stay up to date with the activity going on around you. What was it we were talking about? Mojang.
Minecraft.
Yeah, Mojang uses Atlassian Jira for its Minecraft bugs list.
Yes, in fact, I've submitted and checked bugs on, this is Mojang's Atlassian account, and this is public for the, you know, they've set this up to be public, and so you can easily see, you know, there's an activity
yep.
list. If you jump in here,
what people are doing in response,
things that I like the most.
You just broke it.
No, okay. It's just is that you can merge, you know, if there are duplicate tickets, you can merge them together, make sure you track everything, comments, screenshots, even videos of issues are very easy to
really
attach, add,
system.
Browse,
yeah.
Check through. There's just some really great stats throughout all of this.
I don't know how much Mojang is. I mean, there's so many capabilities. They have literally hundreds of Jira add-ons. They could include test management, time tracking, project management. It integrates with Git, so you can follow your code from development all the way through delivery on a single system. They use REST API, so if you don't have a plugin that you want, it's easy enough to create one. Very flexible, very simple. Used by 5-person startups and 100,000-person enterprises. NASA uses it. 70% of the Fortune 100 uses it. 25,000 companies use Jira, J-I-R-A, from Atlassian. And here's the good news. It's very affordable. Monthly plans start at $10 a month for up to 10 users. And you can try it free for 30 days right now at Atlassian, Atlassian.com/twit. Remember, Atlassian.com/twit. Try Jira for free 30 days. You've been hearing about it. I'm sure you're aware of it. You might want to try it and see how it works in your enterprise. Very sweet stuff. And we thank them so much for their support of This Week in Tech. A secret memo leaked by the Consumerist from Comcast's chief operating officer regarding Ryan Block's very painful call. Dave Watson is the guy who writes this. He says it was painful to listen to this call, and I'm not surprised we've been criticized for it. Now, this was an internal memo sent to Comcast employees, so understand that he's talking not to the public here, but to the Comcast employees. Respecting our customers is fundamental. We fell short in this instance, but this is, this, in a way, smoking gum. The agent on this call, and if you've heard a call, you know the agent was incredibly annoying. Did a lot of what we trained him and paid him and thousands of other retention agents to do. He tried to save a customer, and that's important. The phrase he uses, we make it easy for customers to choose to stay with Comcast. It's another way to say we make it really hard for them not to stay with Comcast. The situation, and I hope this is true and not just fluff, the situation has caused us to re-examine how we do some things and make sure that each and every one of us, from leadership to the front line, understands the balance between selling and listening, and that a great sales organization always listens to the customer first and foremost. We'll see. We shall see. But it's true. Companies like Forbes can incent people to do things that, in the long run, you know, they can see from a abstract is something they want, but they may not want the effect of it.
Well, look, in defense of Forbes, publishers have always done that. The difference is that now individual writers are being incentivized, and that's where incentivized, and that's where it gets a little strange. And I think that those of us who write for any publication that rewards us for hits, whether directly or indirectly, in this, that's how we get to keep our job, need to exercise some restraint and need to remember that we're journalists first and business people second. But
same thing
invented this.
Yep, with clickbait and outing people on social media and all of that.
Absolutely.
Google has
removed faster nowadays.
Well, that's the problem.
When I was doing Byte, the circulation was important. If you didn't manage to make your numbers, you weren't going anywhere. But on the other hand, it took a lot longer to find out whether you were doing it right. Nowadays, you do something wrong and you're instantly known. Leo, I'm going to have to run. I'm at Larry's house and it's time to do other things. And,
all right.
It's been great.
Jerry, a great pleasure to have you. We're wrapping up anyway. I thank you so much for being here, Jerry Pournelle. Of course, go to Amazon. You'll find all of Jerry and Larry's books there. Audible, too. I love listening to Lucifer's Hammer on Audible. It just came alive in my mind. I know maybe that's not quite literate, but that's how I listened, and I loved it. And you got the royalties, so everybody's happy. Thanks, Jerry.
I sure did.
Always a pleasure having you on.
Hi, Jerry.
And give my best to Larry. It was great to talk to him.
All right.
Take care. See you later.
Bye-bye.
91,000 people have requested removal from Google's search results, and they have removed already tens of thousands of links from the European search results. This is all part of the right to be forgotten. Privacy regulators require this of Google. 328,000 URLs have been requested to be removed. It's kind of unbelievable, and I fear that this is going to extend beyond European search results, that ultimately these courts are going to demand, hey, you got these results. Those of us in Europe who know how to use .com are going to be able to find them. You got to be able to remove
proxy server again.
Yeah, you got to remove them globally.
And it's horrible. You know, as a First Amendment advocate, I'm very concerned about this. I mean, what I advocate is the right to be forgiven. I mean, this particular case, some guy had a bankruptcy 15 years ago. And you could find that out by, this is a Spanish guy, right? And you could find that out on Google. Now, the reality is that we shouldn't judge him because he had a bankruptcy 15 years ago. And legally, in most countries, it would have been wiped off the books completely from the standpoint of employment or credit, et cetera. But the reality is it happened. It's part of the historical record. And does he really have a right to be forgotten if something actually happened?
I wonder if Google is not just saying, yeah, whatever. Let's see how that works out. I mean, if I were Google, I would be tempted to say, sure, we'll remove everything. Then see what you got. See what's left.
Yeah. The old Yahoo back in 1988, 98. I mean, that's what would be.
You'd have a human design directory.
Exactly.
No, totally. And then, I mean, to your point, Larry, I'm with you. As a First Amendment advocate, I think that this has terrible implications. But then beyond that, I also feel like this is such a disenfranchising decision, because what it's doing is it's saying that, okay, they don't want to take as big of a step as going to the places where it's actually published and saying that either they need to de-index themselves or they need to remove the items. They're going to Google because they clearly are afraid of whatever censorship things are going to be on. Right. And they know that they wouldn't have a case there. Right. But what they're also not doing is they're not going to – they're going to Google and they're going to Bing and to Yahoo, but they're not going to LexisNexis. They're not going to Westlaw. They're not going to any of the EBSCO. They're not going to any of these big, you know, pay – directories that are going to still have this information that anyone who has money could actually use to go and research something. So to me, it's the ultimate disenfranchising thing too, because it's meaning that if you have money to get into a search database that has access to these documents, you can. But if you're a regular person or if you are someone who, you know, doesn't have anything, then you can't have access to this information.
Go on. One more thing. If somebody spent the last 20 years running safekids.com and connectsafely.org, I think it puts out the wrong message to kids and adults, too. It says you can do whatever you want and you have the right to be forgotten. And the reality is that we are responsible for our behavior. And as you point out, it really isn't totally forgotten anyway. It's still there. There's still a digital record of it. Even if you purged it, even if you were successful purging from the source, there could still be a copy of it that somebody took in a cache. And so the message is not that you should have the right to erase any indiscretion, but you should think before you post, and you should understand. Right. For example, this girl, this Auschwitz selfie girl, let's say she decides that she doesn't want her images found by Google. She can do that, but yes, it won't erase the fact they're all over Twitter, they're all over Facebook, and, you know, they're forever, ever there.
No, exactly. And but to me, I mean, when you're talking about something like a bankruptcy or, a conviction or whatever the case may be, I mean, as you said, these are points of facts. These are things that happened. And to try to remove them, not from the historical record, because we can't do that, but from an index that is run by a private company that is in another country, in another jurisdiction, that is not associated with this, that's not hosting the content, that is merely, you know, hosting, that has an index to the hyperlinks, to me just sets up two worlds of access to information. The world where people who pay can have access, and the world where people can't. I think that's a really nasty precedent. And that's something that to me hasn't come into this at all, but that's really what it creates. It creates two types of access worlds. And that's exactly what the web is supposed to get rid of. Right. So, I mean, all the First Amendment stuff, even separate from that, I think just the fact that it's creating this dual existence of paradigm things is just really, really troubling. And
if I can add one more thing, it also puts Google in the business of making editorial decisions, and we don't want them in that business.
Editorial, it's almost like a court. They're going to have to set up a tribunal of people who will decide each case on its merits, and then you get to be removed, but you don't. Google's removed about half.
I had a bad hair day the other day. Can I have that?
Yeah, please remove that.
Please? Yeah.
No, you may not.
And you know, as I was making this point to someone earlier this week, you know, I think one of the biggest issues is that clearly the regulators in this case do not understand the technology involved. They feel like it's so easy to just remove a link and don't realize that actually there's a lot more to it than that. And removing something from the search results isn't actually removing anything. And I think they're putting this onus on Google to get rid of things that, A, isn't their responsibility even under the guidelines, but B, I think they don't understand how the web works and how hyperlinks at their base level work. And so to me, it's sad that this moves so quickly from a judgment into going into effect, when now they're asking these questions. Google has until the 30th to answer. And I'm feeling like, shouldn't these have been questions that should have been asked before a judgment was put into place, so that you could start thinking about, if there is a policy, how do we enforce this, rather than, well, okay, we've made this law, now now we're going to talk to the company and see how we can enforce it based on what their technical abilities are, which we have no idea what they are because we don't understand them. We just know that this is scary to us, and we don't like that when I Google my name, someone Google bombed me, and or the only things that come up are these things, you know, from this period of time, and it embarrasses me. And, you know, I mean, it's like at a certain point, I think, you know, Larry, to your point earlier, the way to kind of hide that information is to have more of a presence, to have other things going on. But I think in absence of either that or, you know, the right to forgive, the solution isn't to go after the indexer. I mean, it just, I don't know. The whole thing is really troubling.
And but you realize this was the equivalent, the European equivalent of the Supreme Court. This was the highest court.
Yes, no, I know.
So,
yeah.
There's no appeal.
No,
it's a done deal.
I completely understand that. And that's what I'm saying. That's what's so troubling that this decision was decided the way it was without any of the technical knowledge, and that they are asking these questions, you know, the regulators are asking these questions of Google after they've already decided, you know, the ruling, rather than asking those things beforehand. Because to me, I feel like that's, you know, be like our Supreme Court, you know, I mean, to their credit, they don't do everything right, but they bring people in, they bring experts in, they try to learn about the various caveats of what's happening with something before, you know, making a decision. And in this case, I don't feel like there was any, you know, investigation whatsoever done into how, you know, Google actually works and how even, you know, the basics of how a search engine even works. I feel like they went into this with almost no technical knowledge.
Here's a startup. I think the startup of the week, an app for the iPhone called Fixed, the easiest way to fix a parking ticket. Now, it's a you have to get an invite, and it's only San Francisco so far. But when you get a ticket, you take a picture of it, you send it to Fixed. First, they look through the ticket for technicalities, mistakes, and then if they can't find one, they automatically generate a letter on your behalf to San Francisco saying, wow. Oh, we can test this ticket, and they'll fax it as well. You pay nothing until the fine is reversed, in which case you pay 25% of the fine to Fixed. Now, I would, as you might imagine, the city of San Francisco isn't terribly happy about this. Fixed was mailing and faxing the submission. Then the city of San Francisco sent him a letter saying you can't fax it. They quoted California state law, which says, in fact, you can fax it. So they unplugged the fax machine. I don't know if this is... I don't know if this is going to survive or not, but I think
now, Leo, I got a parking ticket the day I got my first smartphone with a camera. It was in L.A. I got a parking ticket on Wilshire Boulevard, and I knew I was innocent. And I said, I've got a camera. I took pictures. I documented my innocence. I appealed it by mail. I still lost. I had an ironclad case. It didn't matter. Now, I could have flown to L.A. and gone
to court. That's what you need to do. You need to go to court.
Exactly.
Yeah.
I paid hundreds of dollars in airfare.
You have to go to court and see if they show up. And then what you're hoping, I mean, usually, because this happened to me a few times, is you hope that no one from you know, the police department shows up to contest your thing. And most of the time, they won't. And so if you get lucky and no one's there, then they'll find it in your favor. But if you were, you know, visiting or something, you're screwed. Right. And it's just easier
Even if you weren't visiting, it's easier to pay a $50 parking fine.
Most cases.
Yeah. Somebody in the chat room suggested, I think it's a great idea. Somebody in the chat room suggested, I think it's a great idea. Just flat fee tickets. You pay a yearly fee.
And how good they are. I like the fact that I like that they're incentivized to win the case. I mean, that you don't pay unless it works. Well, I'll use it.
They've got $1.2 million funding.
And the nice thing, Leo, is I don't have to wait long because I go to San Francisco, I get a ticket. So it.
Hey, I really want to thank you for being here. Of course, Jerry Pournelle, who has already taken off Larry Magid. LarryMagid.com. What is called Larry's World. I'm sorry. Larry'sWorld.com is a place to go to find out about all of Larry's efforts with Safer Kids and so forth. And, of course, you'll hear him on CBS Radio every single day. It's great to see you again, Larry. Thank you for being here.
See you, Leo.
To Christina Warren, who is one of my favorite panelists, and we want to get you back more. Mashable.com. What's your title at Mashable?
I'm our senior tech analyst.
Senior tech analyst at Mashable.com.
Yes. She's not even that old, and she's already senior.
She's senior. Boy, if you're senior at 30, what's next? It's all downhill from
here. Geriatric tech analyst, if I work there.
Anyway, great to have you both.
Thank you so much.
Thank you for being here. Let me just show you a little bit. We had a great week on Twitter. If you missed anything, this is some of what you might have seen.
Previously on Twit.
What? I'm just shocked.
This is really just like sitting around having a beer talking with friends.
Tech News Today.
Microsoft CEO Satya Nadella announced that the company plans to merge the currently separate version of Windows into a single unified version that will run on all devices of all screen sizes.
When queried about this in the Q&A at the end of the call, he said, we will have multiple SKUs for OEMs. We will have multiple SKUs for end users. In other words, nothing's changed.
Security Now.
Microsoft Research published this paper. Guardian, their headline was Microsoft recommends against always using strong passwords. People were like, what? Some sites are not that important.
This Week in Google.
I have just watched all eight seasons of The Kardashians.
Oh, Gina. You've crushed me.
The fact that this app is doing so well, it challenges my notion that these are not smart people.
Twit, now with half the calories.
Look at that cake.
Happy third anniversary, Brick House. We've been here for 3 years. We moved in on July 24th, 2011, and it's been a great home for us, and we hope many more years in the Brick House. We do Twit every Sunday afternoon, 3 p.m. Pacific, 6 p.m. Eastern Time, 2200 UTC. If you stop by, you will be glad you did, I promise. You can watch live and chat with us in the chat room. We even have room for you to come and visit us in the studio if you ever make it up Petaluma way. Just email tickets at twit.tv, and I thank all of you who came today. It's nice to have a live studio audience. But don't worry, if you miss a show, you can always get it after the fact. We make on-demand audio and video always available at twit.tv. On all the apps, Stitcher, we have our own apps in every platform, including Roku. There's a great Twit app. So please take advantage of those, and we want to see you here each and every week. Thanks for joining us. Oh, let's not forget, we have the new Brick House T-shirt. We had a vote. It was a close vote, but this is the design that won. There are a variety of different ways you can get this. It will be available for 1 month only. Can you show the back? Because we spent a lot of time on the back. There it is. That's the Twit Brick House anniversary T-shirt. So I invite you to visit Teespring, TEESpring.com/Twit. We have a couple of different styles. There's a woman's tee as well, different colors, white or black. And I think you'll be very happy with your one-of-a-kind. We've only sold five. Oh, just this is the first anybody said anything about it. Okay, that's why. Go ahead and buy your Brick House T-shirt to commemorate our third anniversary in the Twit Brick House. Thanks, everybody, for being here. We'll see you next week. Another Twit is in the can. Thank you, everybody.